KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
I get it. You don't want a sewer for the federal government, but it just feels like Department of Commerce is trying to hit us while we're down.
Some government workers who were fired, rehired, and fired again are finding out they've lost their health insurance even though they kept paying premiums.
For Friday, April 25th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Juana Summers. This hour, NATO's Secretary General reflects on how the U.S. is approaching the war in Ukraine.
And we have a profile of Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, who was in Moscow today trying to negotiate an end to the war.
Clearly, they have a very strong personal bond that allows Witkoff to play the role like family.
Later, a preview of the Pope's funeral.
And in New Orleans, this weekend is Jazz Fest.
Jazz Fest is kind of like the local mecca for performance.
Plus, it's a big moment for the NFL's smallest market.
The draft comes to Green Bay, Wisconsin.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. A federal judge has halted President Trump's executive order ending collective bargaining rights for most federal employees. As NPR's Andrea Hsu reports, the White House had argued the move was necessary to ensure the security of the country.
The case was brought by the National Treasury Employees Union, which represents federal employees across several dozen agencies. The union argued that stripping federal workers of their collective bargaining rights had nothing to do with national security, but instead was punishment for the union's legal challenges to the president's actions, including his mass firings of employees. U.S. District Judge Paul Friedman granted the union's request to block federal agencies from implementing the executive order, finding it unlawful. That preserves collective bargaining rights at agencies where NTEU has members, for now. Already, many agencies had stopped allowing employees to have their union dues taken out of their paychecks. Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
President Trump says talks aimed at brokering a deal to end Russia's war in Ukraine have gone well. His envoy, Steve Witkoff, met today with Russian President Vladimir Putin. They are very close to a deal, and the two sides should now meet at very high levels to finish it off, Trump said in his post. Quote, most of the major points are agreed to. We will, however, be working whatever is necessary to help facilitate the end of the cruel and senseless war, Trump wrote. The price in Gaza of the little food left on the markets is now soared by as much as 1,400%. The UN says that's because Israel has been blocking the entry of everything into Gaza for months, and food is running out. And bureaus Ayub Trawi has more.
The UN World Food Program says it has no more stocks of food to support charity kitchens in Gaza. The soupy beans served at these charity kitchens are what half of Gaza has been surviving on. But the UN agency says these hot kitchens will now run out of food in the coming days. Already, all of Gaza's bakeries shut down weeks ago because flour and cooking fuel ran out. There's more than 100,000 tons of food aid ready to enter Gaza, along with medical supplies and other life-saving aid. But Israel's government is blocking all of it, saying this is to pressure Hamas to release Israeli hostages. Aid groups and countries around the world say Israel's violating international law. A young boy died over the weekend in Gaza from hunger, one of 53 children the health ministry says have died from malnutrition in the war. Ayub Altraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
President Trump has backed off his contention he could fire Fed Chairman Jerome Powell if he wanted to, saying he does not now plan to do that. However, Trump has not given up on calling on Powell and even the central bank to cut short-term interest rates. And if the Fed were to lower rates now, most economists say would not necessarily reduce borrowing costs for consumers. That's because they say administration's tax policies are inflationary, driving the Fed to keep rates higher for longer to prevent inflation from taking off even more. Stocks gained ground on Wall Street. The Dow was up 20 points. The Nasdaq rose 216 points. This is NPR. Scientists have had 1 week to pore over claims that a distant planet is showing possible signs of life. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports one astronomer has already done a new analysis that casts doubt on the findings.
Jake Taylor at the University of Oxford specializes in using the James Webb Space Telescope to study the atmospheres of faraway planets. So he reanalyzed the published data from the group that claimed to have found life-associated gases on planet K2-18b. His conclusion? There's too much noise in the data to reliably detect any signals. The researchers who made the original claims say that this analysis was too simplistic to be relevant, but Taylor disagrees, saying it's a commonly used method. More reassessments are expected in the coming weeks as the full set of data from the telescope's observations of this planet will be made public on Saturday. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Luigi Mangione, the man accused of gunning down UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson on a Manhattan street, has pleaded not guilty in federal court today. The 26-year-old Mangione faces the death penalty in the case. Today's arraignment attracted several dozen people to the courthouse, including former Army intelligence analyst Chelsea Manning, who spent 7 years behind bars for stealing classified government information. Crude oil futures prices moved higher today, though they are still down a bit for the week, with the oil market under pressure due to expected oversupply and uncertainty over the future of U.S.-China trade talks. Oil rose 23 cents a barrel to $63.02 a barrel in New York. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from Sony Pictures Classics with On Swift Horses, starring Daisy Edgar Jones and Jacob Elordi. A married woman explores a secret love upon the arrival of her brother-in-law, who gambles on his own hidden romance. Now playing in theaters.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro in Culver City, California.
And I'm Juana Summers in Washington. Pope Francis's coffin has been sealed after 3 days of lying in state in St. Peter's Basilica. Now the Vatican is making final preparations for his funeral Saturday morning. Joining us from Rome to talk about what to expect from the funeral and the conclave to follow are NPR's religion correspondent Jason DeRose and Religion News Service Vatican correspondent Claire Jean Gravet, who are standing just outside St. Peter's Square. Hi to both of you.
Hello.
Hello.
Jason, I want to start with you. Tell us what we know about the funeral itself.
Well, first, let me apologize for the commotion and perhaps the helicopters circling above here just outside St. Peter's Square. What we know about the service is that it's a traditional Roman Catholic Requiem Mass, a service that prays for God to grant the deceased eternal peace. The Mass is predominantly in Latin, the official language of the Church, but some of the elements are in other languages, Arabic, Portuguese, Chinese, languages spoken in places outside Europe, in the Global South, where the Church is growing and, frankly, more vibrant. The very traditional psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd," will be part of the liturgy, and the gospel reading is from John. It's the story of Jesus asking Simon Peter 3 times, "Do you love me?" Simon Peter says, "Yes," 3 times, and each time Jesus says, "Feed my flock." I'll be interested in hearing how the homily might reflect Francis' understanding of himself as a shepherd. And then near the end of the Requiem Mass is this incredibly moving antiphon, In Paradisum. It's sung in Latin, but the text translates this way: "May the angels lead you into paradise."
Claire, to you, the Pope is not actually going to be buried at St. Peter's, but instead at St. Mary Major Basilica. Tell us why.
Yes, in many ways, this is another break from tradition for Pope Francis. The last pope to be buried in St. Mary Major was in the 1600s. This was a choice really born from Pope Francis's own special devotion to Mary. He wanted to be buried as close as possible to one of the most ancient and precious icons of the Virgin Mary, the Salus Populus Romani. Now, Pope Francis would go and pray in front of that icon before and after every trip, and even when he left the hospital where he was treated for double pneumonia. Greeting his body on Saturday on the steps of St. Mary Major, there will be a number of people representing all those that Pope Francis helped during his life. The unhoused, the trans community, prisoners and migrants will be there, holding a white rose. They say this will be their last goodbye.
Jason, what happens after the funeral and the burial?
The funeral, Juana, marks the beginning of something called the Novemdialis. It's this ancient tradition of 9 days of mourning and daily masses for the repose of the late pope's soul. But the cardinals will be busy outside those masses. They're meeting in congregations to get to know each other. Francis appointed the vast majority of electors, so this is the first time they'll all be coming together to think about the current state of the Catholic Church, what they're looking for in the next pope, and what issues the future pope might need to address. And then following those meetings and masses, the conclave itself begins when all the electors are cloistered in the Sistine Chapel and at a nearby guest house until they select the next leader of the Roman Catholic Church.
Claire, so many of us have been watching this, and there has been just a lot of talk about who might be emerging as front runners in the conclave to elect the next pope. Tell us a bit about what we might expect from this conclave and when it might begin.
Well, even though an official date has not been released by the Vatican yet, we can expect that sometime around May 6th, cardinals will convene for the conclave. Now, there are 200 cardinals overall, but only 135 will be voting because they are under the age of 80. The older cardinals will, even if they can't vote, have an important role in advising the conversation. But conversations about who might be the next pope are already happening in Rome. Pietro Parolin has emerged as a very probable candidate. He is a respected figure in the church as the number two official at the Vatican and a close ally to Pope Francis. For conservatives, the Hungarian Cardinal Peter Erdo seems like an obvious choice, as someone who can bridge divides between East and West while upholding tradition. Many think that it's time for an Italian to come back and become pope, and for them, Cardinal Zuppi might be a favorite, especially among progressives in Italy. And there will be many cardinals from Asia in this conclave who think that the Filipino Cardinal Tagle might be the right choice for his strong charisma and outreach towards young people. But it's difficult to predict what happens in the Sistine Chapel once those doors are closed, and we really don't know who the next pope will be until he appears on the balcony of St. Peter's Basilica.
That's Religion News Service Vatican correspondent Claire Jean Gravet and NPR's religion correspondent Jason DeRose. They're both in Rome. Claire and Jason, thank you so much for your reporting.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
This story was produced through a collaboration between NPR and Religion News Service.
The head of NATO, Secretary General Mark Rutte, is in Washington this week to meet with President Trump and senior U.S. officials. He spoke to Morning Edition co-host Michelle Martin earlier today, and he had some words of praise for Trump's approach on Russia's war in Ukraine.
I think the U.S. is really trying to, and President Trump's team and he himself really tried to, in an even-handed way, bring this whole process forward. It will mean compromises on all sides.
That's even as European leaders have expressed shock and alarm at the U.S. administration's apparent concessions to Russia. But Rutte also criticized Russia's recent deadly attacks on its neighbor.
The attack on Kyiv, a residential area, people just going about their lives, 12 people killed because of an indiscriminate attack by the Russians on that part of Kyiv. But also I was in Odessa the other week with President Zelensky, and I've seen the devastation there when attacks take place and these missiles come in this beautiful, beautiful city. This is not a sign of strength by the Russians. If they really are winning this, they would not do this. It is clearly a sign of the weakness on the Russian side.
NATO is the world's largest military alliance. Rutte is preparing for its annual summit in June. It'll come at a time when the Trump administration is pressing European allies to contribute more to their own defense, while seeking to reduce American involvement in several international conflicts beyond the Russia-Ukraine war.
Obviously, the U.S. has to take care of more issues than only Europe and the Euro-Atlantic. There's also the Middle East, there's also the Indo-Pacific. But I'm absolutely convinced we will do this in a step-by-step approach. But it's only logical. Everybody understands that.
You can hear more of Michelle Martin's interview with NATO Secretary General Mark Rutte Monday on Morning Edition. New Orleans' highly anticipated Jazz and Heritage Festival starts this weekend. After being disappointed he wasn't selected to perform at the Super Bowl this year, Lil Wayne is now headlining Jazz Fest. Joseph King with the Gulf States Newsroom reports it's a big moment for hip-hop artists in the city.
New Orleans and music are synonymous. Jazz music and brass bands may be the first things that come to mind for most people. But over the last couple of decades, you can't mention music in New Orleans without bounce or hip-hop in the conversation. At Jazz Fest, you can hear a little bit of everything, from rock and bluegrass to Alfred Banks. He says if you're a musician from New Orleans, you want to perform there.
Jazz Fest is kind of like the local, I guess you could say, mecca for performance.
Banks is a rapper born and raised in Uptown New Orleans. He has performed a few times at Jazz Fest, mostly on the smaller stage.
Like, that's just where you play. Like, if you're a black artist, you know you're playing Congress Square Stage.
Banks says it seems rap artists, whether national or local, tend to play that stage.
It does feel like no matter how big you get or how much notoriety you get, you're probably playing Congress Square. And that's just kind of where the artists go.
But one rapper who won't be on that stage this year is New Orleans' own Lil Wayne. Banks says that's because he will share the main stage with the Roots, the Tonight Show band.
I don't know if I'd be wrong to say this, but I don't think he would have got booked if he didn't have the Roots with him. You know what I mean?
Getting Lil Wayne, of course, is a real coup.
That's Lewis Edwards. He's the associate producer of Jazz Fest. He controls a lot of the creative elements at the festival.
That name has definitely been on a post-it on my desk for a long time.
Then last summer, he saw Lil Wayne perform with the Roots at a concert in Philadelphia. Seeing him with a live band, Edwards was convinced that they would be a great fit for the main stage in New Orleans.
That was new, that was fresh. We felt like it was something that would play really well at the festival. We love it when the music is really acoustic and it's live, and this was going to deliver that.
Locally, Jazz Fest is sometimes known as Dad Fest, but Edwards says it caters to every generation and has embraced hip-hop since its inception.
Whether it's, you know, Juvenile and Onas, Common, Drake has played Jazz Fest. I don't know that, you know, those artists are thought of as just appealing to middle-aged people.
Another rapper on the main stage right before Lil Wayne is none other than the queen of bounce herself, Big Freedia.
Jazz Fest is expanding their horizon, and they are trying to bring more of our black folks to come in to support the Jazz Fest.
Big Freedia has performed all over the world, but says it's nothing like performing at home.
You get to see the local acts, you get to see the Mardi Gras Indians and the whole cultural thing behind that. You get to, you know, experience all of these different, you know, food vendors, and, you know, it's just no experience like that.
Her music is a testament of how hip-hop intersects with a variety of genres and fits seamlessly into the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival. For NPR News, I'm Joseph Kay. Watch me catch the spirit, but I'ma never fly spirit. I ain't gon' do it. Always keep it in first class. Heaven stamped on my ticket. Hair, press, dress, down, nail, gun, for the one. Amen. When they see me, no, I ain't nothing to play with. Holy water, drifting, clutter, all designer, father, father. Oh, yes. Breaking necks in my Sunday best. Sunday best, what?
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. We'll be right back.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering hydrangeas, lilacs, evergreens, and more. Their full collection is at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From Easy Cater, committed to helping organizations order and manage food for all their business needs, with online ordering from restaurants nationwide, employee meal programs, and tools to control food expenses, at easycater.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. The Trump administration's slashing of the federal workforce is not just displacing workers, it's disrupting entire households. Some are just learning that health coverage they thought they had their whole family on has ended. NPR's Andrea Hsu reports.
The day I met Danielle Waterfield, she was supposed to be at physical therapy. But a day earlier, she'd canceled the appointment, telling them,
"I'm sorry, I've just learned today that I may not have coverage."
That's despite the fact she was paying her healthcare premiums through her paychecks continuously. Jennifer Rollin learned last week her family was no longer insured. Her older son just turned 11, but
I haven't been able to set up his well visit appointment. Can't get his vaccines.
And on top of that,
both of my children play baseball. And so now every time they have a game, I hold my breath and hope that they don't get hurt.
Rollin and Waterfield work for two different branches of the Commerce Department. Both were booted from their jobs almost 2 months ago in President Trump's mass purge of probationary employees, typically the more recent hires. Now, weeks later, a federal judge ruled their firings were probably illegal and ordered them reinstated. But then a few weeks after that, an appeals court vacated that order and they were fired again, dating back to their original termination dates. As the court battle continues, Rollin sums it up this way.
We have been living in purgatory for the past couple months, but this whole healthcare thing has really taken a darker turn.
How this whole healthcare thing came about is emblematic of the Trump administration's break first, ask questions later approach to remaking the federal government. Firings have been carried out with such haste that HR departments have struggled to answer questions. And now hundreds of Commerce Department employees may be in this precarious position with lapsed healthcare coverage. Danielle Waterfield says it feels like an attack on her family's security.
To pull the rug out like this without any warning is inhumane, in my opinion. It completely ignores the fact that you're dealing with people.
The Commerce Department has not responded to NPR's questions about these employees' health benefits, but here's what we've gathered. After the employees were first fired, many were told their health coverage would end on April 8th, 31 days after their last pay period. They were given instructions for how they could do the federal employee version of COBRA and keep their coverage, fairly standard for anyone with employer-sponsored health care. The real chaos began when they were reinstated a couple weeks later. They were brought back and put on paid leave. Rollin says a supervisor assured her that health benefits were being restored. Plus, she was still paying her premium through her paycheck.
So as far as we were concerned, we were still covered.
Danielle Waterfield wanted to play it safe. She sent her insurer her reinstatement letter and was told, all good, no break in coverage.
Within a week, I had new insurance cards sent to my entire family.
By then, she'd already looked into moving the family to her husband's health insurance. She feels lucky to have that option. But she learned she can't do that until she can prove she's lost her coverage. So she thought, well, since I've been paying the premiums, let's move some doctor's visits up. A routine checkup for her teenager, a diabetes appointment for her husband, her own physical therapy for a spinal issue.
They rescheduled things and got us in.
Only this week did her colleagues start learning from their insurers that no claims after April 8th will be paid. Waterfield fears she's in the same boat.
I'm afraid to call my insurance company.
She says her family's probably racked up several $1,000s in medical bills in recent weeks. Now, Jennifer Rollin knows for sure her insurance lapsed on April 8th. Late last week, she finally got an email from the government about her benefits telling her so. Now she's furious.
I get it. You don't want us to work for the federal government, but it just feels like Department of Commerce is trying to hit us while we're down.
She says she still hasn't received the paperwork she needs to get on her husband's insurance. What she's been told is that she still has a small window to restore her coverage, paying 102% of the entire cost of her federal health care benefits. Without a job, she says, how could she afford that? Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
In the offseason, NFL teams select the best college football players in the country to join their rosters. This year, the draft is being held in Green Bay, Wisconsin, the NFL's smallest market. It's broadcast on TV, and it's also a big three-day on-site festival for football fans and the teams they love. And all of that excitement and investment can be a boon for the host city. Wisconsin Public Radio's Joe Schultz reports.
Go Pack, go! Go Pack, go!
This has been an exciting moment for Green Bay Packers fans and for plenty of others. On the first night of the draft, the NFL says more than 200,000 people showed up. That's roughly twice the population of Green Bay. As chance filled the Lambeau Field parking lot, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell welcomed everyone from an event stage outside the stadium.
Welcome to the 2025 NFL Draft in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
And later, when Packers president Mark Murphy announced Green Bay's first-round pick Thursday night was wide receiver Matthew Golden, the crowd erupted again before he even said the player's name.
For the first time since 2002,
it's the first time in more than two decades that the Packers have been able to select a wide receiver in the opening round of the draft. For many, like lifelong fan Tyler Schramm, it was a long time coming.
For it to actually happen on the biggest stage in Green Bay, Wisconsin, means the world to the fans.
Maybe almost as much as winning the Super Bowl. But Green Bay is actually too small to host the Super Bowl. It doesn't have enough hotel rooms, and the game is typically played in the middle of Wisconsin's frigid winters. That's why Aaron Popke, the director of public affairs for the Green Bay Packers, says it was great when the NFL decided to take the draft on the road.
But I think the idea of the draft was something that they could bring to communities that wouldn't necessarily get the Super Bowl, and it is our Super Bowl.
The local visitors bureau and the Packers have spent nearly a decade working to bring the draft to town. Brad Toll, the president of the visitors bureau, says he hopes football's big event raises Green Bay's profile.
55 million plus will actually see the draft on TV, will view it, so they will be able to see Green Bay. Imagine us trying to buy advertising where we could have that many impressions to people literally all over the world.
He isn't the only one who welcomes the national spotlight. Cora Billitz made the trip from the Milwaukee area. She says she's excited for others to experience the stadium and its atmosphere.
I mean, I think it's great that we get to finally show off Lambeau and why Wisconsin residents love Lambeau Field so much.
It's not just excited Wisconsinites, though. There are fans from all over the country supporting their teams. One of them is Kelly Basil. He's from Florida and roots for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. He says he attends a draft party back home each year.
But this is my first on-site draft. I just still been on my bucket list as well.
Basil also says events like the draft and game day tailgates help forge a sense of camaraderie between fans. That sense of community is one of his favorite things about the sport.
So there's a big bonding thing that goes on with the tailgating. So that's a big part of it, especially when your team's struggling over different seasons. It's, you know, you take the good with the bad, but really the tailgating and the bonding with family and friends, that's the most important part.
The wider Green Bay community also has a slate of events throughout the city to complement the action near the stadium. The NFL draft runs through Saturday. For NPR News, I'm Joe Schultz in Green Bay.
This is NPR News.
Saturday is the funeral for Pope Francis, and our team of reporters will cover this from Rome. We'll also look ahead to the papal conclave that gathers soon to choose his successor. Then the latest political news and a new book that remembers James Gandolfini, who was a lot nicer than Tony Soprano. Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
That's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Next, the musician Samia on her new album, Bloodless.
I was really fascinated with the concept of absence. So, like, whatever isn't there holds more promise and more possibility than what's there.
Plus, the FBI charges a Wisconsin judge with helping an immigrant evade federal authorities.
First, the newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. New polls show that approval ratings for President Trump have steadily fallen during his first 3 months in office. NPR's Domenico Montanaro reports his numbers have dropped to about 45%, down from 52% a week after he took office.
All of them are pointing to in a downward direction for Trump. In particular, his economic numbers have plunged into the 30s, and his numbers on foreign policy, even immigration, are down too. Not great news as the president approaches 100 days in office next week, but is potentially even worse for Republican members of Congress who have to run for re-election next year. Trump, of course, on the other hand, is constitutionally barred from running for a third term, though that hasn't stopped the Trump store from going up this week with Trump 2028 hats and t-shirts.
That's NPR's Domenico Montanaro reporting. Israel's far-right security minister received a mixed reception during his visit to the U.S. this week. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi reports the official has advocated for the displacement of Palestinians outside Israel.
While Israeli Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir didn't meet with President Trump, he did attend an event at Trump's Mar-a-Lago resort where he said he met with senior Republican officials whom he did not name. Ben-Gvir posted on social media that these officials supported his position to bomb food aid depots in Gaza as a means to pressure Hamas to return the more than 50 Israeli hostages still being held there. The Israeli security minister is known for his ultra-nationalist views and advocacy to expel Arabs. He was banned from serving in the army because he was deemed too extremist. Anti-Gaza war protesters hurled water bottles at Ben-Gvir as he left an event hosted by a Jewish group based at Yale University. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Stocks closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow was up 20 points. The S&P gained 40. The Nasdaq Composite also traded higher, up 216 points. This is NPR News. Former Congressman George Santos was sentenced to more than 7 years in prison today. The New York Republican was convicted of wire fraud and aggravated identity theft charges last year. Santos served in Congress for less than a year before he was ousted by his colleagues in the House. He admitted to deceiving donors and stealing the identities of nearly a dozen people to fund his campaign. Luigi Maggioni pleaded not guilty to a federal murder charge in a New York City courtroom today. Ben Fuhrhard of member station WNYC reports the 26-year-old is accused of killing UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson.
Weeks after Attorney General Pam Bondi said publicly that the Justice Department would seek the death penalty in his case, Maggioni pleaded not guilty to his federal charges in Manhattan. After he entered his plea, a federal judge set a briefing schedule and discussed other procedural matters. The judge, Margaret Garnett, also noted a law that limits what each side can say publicly about the case to not affect Mangione's right to a fair trial. Garnett instructed the federal prosecutors to raise the issue with Bondi and her associates at the Justice Department. Mangione's attorneys have argued that Bondi's public statement about the death penalty was political and could influence the case. Mangione is due back in court in December. For NPR News, I'm Ben Fuhrhard in New York.
Recapping stocks on Wall Street, the Dow up 20 points today. The Nasdaq rose 216. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from listeners like you, who donate to this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Juana Summers in Washington.
And I'm Ari Shapiro in Culver City, California. Early this morning, FBI agents arrested a county judge in Milwaukee on federal charges. The judge, Hannah Dugan, is accused of helping a man try to evade a planned arrest at her courthouse by immigration authorities. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas is here to explain what we know. Hi, Ryan.
Hi there.
To start with the person at the center of this, what can you tell us about Judge Hannah Dugan?
Well, she's 65 years old. She's had a long career in the legal career in the Milwaukee area. She's a former president of the Milwaukee Bar Association. For several years, she served as the executive director of the Catholic Charities of the Archdiocese of Milwaukee. A local news article, when she left that job, actually described her as a longtime advocate for the vulnerable and the poor. She currently serves, of course, as a Milwaukee County Circuit Judge. It's an elected position. She was elected to the bench in 2016. Her current term expires in 2028. But federal agents, as you noted, arrested her around 8:30 this morning at the courthouse.
And what are the charges? What do prosecutors say she did?
Well, she faces two counts, obstruction and concealing an individual to prevent an arrest. According to court papers, a federal agent showed up at the county courthouse on April 18th to arrest a man who was set to appear before Judge Dugan that morning. The man was there on misdemeanor charges of domestic assault, but ICE was there to arrest him for allegedly being in the U.S. unlawfully. Prosecutors say that Dugan became aware that ICE was there to arrest the man. Court papers say that she was visibly upset. She confronted the agents. They allegedly showed her a warrant for the man's arrest, and they agreed to wait until after the court hearing before her to arrest him in the public hallway of the courthouse. But court papers say that Dugan later escorted the man and his attorney out of her courtroom through a back door, so away from ICE agents waiting in the public hallway outside her courtroom. And the man left the courthouse. Federal agents saw him leave. They chased him outside and eventually caught him and arrested him.
This seems like a really big step for the FBI to go after a judge in a case like this. How significant is it?
Well, it certainly is significant. It's an escalation for sure in the Trump administration's clash with the judiciary. It also sends a message about the priority that immigration enforcement is for the White House. Attorney General Pam Bondi was on Fox News today. She was asked about this. Here's a little bit of what she said.
I think some of these judges think they are beyond and above the law, and they are not.
She also said the Justice Department is sending what she called a strong message with this arrest. She said no matter who you are, if you're harboring anyone who is in this country illegally, she says the Justice Department will come after you and prosecute you. It is rare for something like this to happen, for the feds to arrest a sitting judge, but it is not the first time that federal agents have done so. Federal agents arrested a judge back in 2018, so during the first Trump administration. A judge in Massachusetts faced federal charges for allegedly allowing someone to leave a courthouse through a back door to evade arrest by ICE, so very similar circumstances. That was tied up in the courts for years before the Biden Justice Department struck a deal to drop the felony charges and instead refer the judge to a commission on judicial conduct.
Well, in today's case, what's the response been in Milwaukee, and what happens next?
The mayor of Milwaukee, Cavalier Johnson, criticized the Trump administration over Dugan's arrest. He said that it will deter people without legal status from coming to court. Here's a little bit of what he said.
They're not going to participate in court cases if they fear being swept up in immigration enforcement. That's exactly the groundwork that the Trump administration has laid here in what is quite evidently an attempt to showboat. And it's unfortunate. I think it makes our community less safe.
Now, Dugan was in court today for her initial appearance. Her attorney said that Dugan regrets and protests her arrest. He said it was not made in the interest of public safety. Dugan, though, was released after her court hearing, and she's scheduled to reappear for her arraignment in the middle of next month.
NPR's Ryan Lucas, thank you.
Thank you.
President Trump's envoy Steve Witkoff was back in Moscow today trying to broker a deal with Vladimir Putin to end the war in Ukraine. Tomorrow he'll be in Oman for nuclear talks with Iran's foreign minister. And he's also been the lead player in trying to reach a ceasefire in Gaza. This would be a massive portfolio for a veteran diplomat, but Witkoff is a newcomer to international diplomacy. NPR White House correspondent Franco Ordonez has more.
President Trump calls Steve Witkoff a special guy. They've been friends for almost 40 years.
You know, people don't realize Steve started out as a lawyer, very good lawyer, top
lawyer in New York, and then he said, I'm going to go in the real estate business because I can do this too. He saw me do it, and he said, if Trump can do it, I guess I can do it, right?
During the campaign, Witkoff described how Trump was there for him when one of his sons died from an opioid overdose in 2011.
I have seen his humanity in the quiet moments, away from the spotlight, in hospital rooms he didn't have to be in.
Once in office, Trump picked his old friend as his envoy to the Middle East. It was a surprising pick, but this was the same position that Trump in his first term gave to another person whose loyalty was unquestioned, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Kushner also came from the real estate world and handled many tough files for Trump. A lot of experts scoffed at Kushner's lack of experience, and they're raising the same questions about Witkoff now.
I'm sure that he is a very successful real estate executive, but not all negotiations and deals are the same.
Stephen Cook is at the Council on Foreign Relations. He says Witkoff is the de facto national security advisor, but worries he doesn't know enough about the history and nuance of these issues.
And my concern is, and I think the concern of lots of others, is that the president and Mr. Witkoff see Iran nuclear negotiations or, you know, a ceasefire agreement in Gaza as very similar to a negotiating real estate deal, and they're very, very different.
Aaron David Miller was a State Department negotiator in both Democratic and Republican administrations. He says the bigger problem is that the three conflicts Witkoff is tasked with are, quote, galactic challenges, where the complexities and the differences between those involved are as wide as the Grand Canyon.
I mean, you can't do this stuff on the back of a cocktail napkin. And I think it's very hard to task one individual, as talented as he may be, and make him the envoy for everything.
The White House says Witkoff is a trusted friend of the president who left behind a massive business enterprise to serve the country. He doesn't take a salary and pays for his own travel. A spokeswoman, Anna Kelly, says Witkoff's successes speak for themselves, citing his work helping secure the release of American Mark Fogel in Russia and hostages trapped in Gaza. Witkoff fueled some criticism recently after appearing on Tucker Carlson's podcast. Witkoff described Russian President Vladimir Putin as, quote, not a bad guy. In the interview, Witkoff explained his approach to negotiations.
Well, there's no doubt I'm always trying to put myself in the shoes of the other person, because a good deal has to work for everybody.
Don Peebles has seen that firsthand in adversarial talks with Witkoff.
If I were going to summarize his approach, is to find what the other side wants and to try to give it to him.
Peebles is a real estate developer who fundraised for former President Barack Obama. He says Witkoff probably has more high-stakes negotiating experience than most diplomats. He remembers being forced to deal with Witkoff on a big real estate transaction in New York.
It was a major building project. And his benefactor, if you will, I needed them. And so it's almost like they had a gun to my head. But Steve never pointed a gun to my head. And he defused the situation and got me to get over it.
And not only did they get the deal done, but they've been friends ever since. Franco Ordonez, NPR News, The White House.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Religious tradition is not handed down fully formed from God on high. It's made by people and shaped by human factors like politics, faith, fear, geography, and community. And sometimes how pretty something looks on Instagram. Dina Prisha brings us the story of Schlissel Challah.
Many Jews recently observed Passover by avoiding leavened products for 8 days. No bread, lots of matzah. And for this first Shabbat after Passover, there will be a triumphant return to fluffy, golden loaves of challah, but with a key difference.
So I like to start with the central sort of top of the key shape.
Food writer Sonia Sanford is making a Schlissel challah. This post-Passover challah comes from the Orthodox tradition, where challahs are either baked with a key inside or braided into the shape of a key. Sanford's looks like it could open some magical yeasted fairy house. It's made from several braids looped together.
You can press it in gently, but it will sort of bake into each other. It's going to really expand as it bakes.
After a slow rise and a sprinkle of sesame seeds, it goes in the oven. As with a lot of home customs, the origins of Schlissel Challah aren't super clear. Like, why even a key at all? Shana Weiss teaches Jewish studies at Brandeis University.
And it's supposed to be what's called a segula, which is like a sort of good luck omen for parnasa, for livelihood.
Weiss says the earliest mentions of Schlissel Challah are from the 19th century. But it is kind of perfect for the current social media moment. Search hashtag Schlissel Challah, and you will see examples from rustic to ridiculously ornate, from home bakers and Orthodox challah influencers, and people baking Schlissel Challah specifically because they saw a picture online.
And I think any time you put something on Instagram, it's a performance. And it, of course, raises the question, right? Like, if you make a Schlissel Challah and you don't take a picture of it, right, does it even count? But I don't want to assume that the performance is automatically inauthentic or sort of not real.
Weiss says Schlissel Challah can be just as real as any other ritual. And while Sephardic families have a ceremony to mark the end of Passover, for Jews with roots in Eastern Europe, there's a bit of a ritual vacuum.
Passover starts with a huge bang, right? You clean a lot. The Seder is this really long, dramatic ceremony, and it can end with sort of a whimper.
A beautiful Schlissel Challah can mark that end. And Weiss says people aren't just playing around with the pretty shape. They're also reinterpreting the meaning.
It's a great symbol, right? It works for all sorts of things, that this key can unlock the door to whatever you want it to be.
For Sonia Sanford, whose Schlissel Challah is starting to smell amazing, it's an opportunity to make the ritual anew every year.
We can all set intentions for this new cycle. It's spring. There's these ideas of liberation. What else do we want to liberate? What do we want to step into?
Sanford's family immigrated from Ukraine because of religious persecution.
I always feel like the freedom I have to have these rituals, to celebrate them openly, to post about them online, is sort of a miracle and one not to be taken for granted.
Sanford says there are a few ways to improve your chances of a beautiful Schlissel Challah. Make sure the dough rises fully so it holds its shape in the oven. Do a double egg wash for a golden finish. But she says even a misshapen challah can be meaningful and delicious and shared with family and friends, which is the real key to the ritual. For NPR News, I'm Dina Prichep.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Sometimes an idea needs a very specific setting to blossom. For the singer-songwriter Samia, it was an Airbnb in Old Fort, North Carolina.
We're in a big A-frame in the woods, and we had one can of biscuits and a 24-pack of Miller Lights, and we just sort of sat there and listened to it.
It was a new song.
We left it looping for what I think ended up being like 18 hours or something. We slept to it and we ate to it. It just felt like we'd finally like birthed the spirit of this thing, and like, especially sonically, like we figured out where the album was going to sit after that song, and so we just kind of wanted to like bask in it for a second.
That album is out today. It's her third, and it's called Bloodless. At its heart is a theme which Samia plays with from lots of different angles.
I was really fascinated with the concept of absence and just how powerful absence can be. So, like, whatever isn't there holds more promise and more possibility than what's there.
When we chatted, I asked about one of the songs that explores this theme. It is called Bovine Excision, which refers to a rare, mysterious phenomenon in which farmers find their cattle dead in the fields, drained of blood.
I just loved this bloodlessness as a metaphor. The thing that makes bovine excision so exciting is, where is the blood? Why isn't it there? And then, you know, it can sort of become anything in your mind.
Your voice is beautiful there,
aside from
anything else, just lovely. The image you're wrestling with, though, is anything but beautiful. So link for me, just what is it that you're playing with here, that you're exploring?
I'm playing with the desire to be an idea, to exist as an idea. I just love that with cattle mutilation, the meaning and the magnitude of it relies on remaining unsolved, so... Yeah, I'm just saying, like, I don't want to have to contend with my humanness anymore. I don't want to have to be reduced to my humanness. I want to be anything.
Mm. You play a lot on this album with the absence of something. I mean, in this first song, you're talking about the absence of blood and where that led you to explore when you were writing songs. There's also a song about a hole punched in a wall by Sid Vicious of the Sex Pistols.
Yeah. The real meaning of it revolves around the power of a void or the power of an absence. And with the literal hole left in the wall by Sid Vicious was this perfect representation of that to me. Like, why, you know, it creates this enormous myth, right? Like, why did he do that? What was he like? People want to come and see this literal absence.
Where is this wall, by the way, that he punched a hole through?
At Kane's Ballroom in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
And it's still there, the hole, the wall?
Oh, it's still there, yeah. And it's framed with a plaque. That says Sid's Fist.
So what do you do with that for this song?
I just referenced it, and I was just thinking about that idea in the context of my own life, and like, I feel more comfortable. I like the person I get to be when I'm gone, when it's just a memory of me or an idea of me. It feels like there's so much more freedom, and your absence sort of grows in value with time, where your like human body does maybe the opposite of that. So that was where that started. Maybe I was born for this, dying
to myself while you hold the oars. So this is so interesting because you're talking about being gone, about absence. And we're talking about how that aligns with the physical act of singing, which is a full body experience. Did you feel, were you playing with that relationship? And how, like, how can you sing about absence when we're feeling, I mean, I can hear your lungs filling as you're doing this.
That's so funny. That's such a good question. Yeah, there's so many contradictions there. And I think with the journey of this, like, sort of what ended up being a highly conceptual thing ended with me realizing, you know, or maybe I'd always known, the thing I'm really after is being known and making real genuine connections. And so this is sort of directly impedes that goal. And so, yeah, being able to like feel myself singing it and be, I think it was a battle with the concept sort of the whole time. And ultimately, like, having to really be there while I was talking about not being there was hilarious.
There's us again in a 747 over the ocean. That's how you ruin that.
I gather from reading a couple of recent interviews with you that there's another big theme in your writing and in these songs that is front and center, grappling with the way that men have projected expectations onto you.
Yeah, it's so funny because it's not even about any real expectations that I've faced from any real men. It's just the idea of what they might want, which is something I know I was socialized to care about.
Anticipating the expectations.
Anticipating the expectations, exactly. And I'd found that I built this personality around a set of criteria that I just imagined hypothetical men would want. And, you know, coming to that realization was tricky. And then it introduced this process of trying to work backwards from there and trying to unlearn all of that, hoping that like underneath that would be some pure self that existed in a vacuum after all this time. You know, there's something to get back to. And what I found was that there was not. And then that, you know, became a journey of acceptance of the whole thing.
Point me toward a song where that shows up on this album.
Pants, it's the final song where I am just sort of like, yeah, I think whatever I am is just a conglomerate of all the little things I've learned, everything anyone's ever said to me, everything I've thought people might want from me. And just it's like a lint ball that is ever evolving, rolling forever.
I also loved this song because we're talking about all kinds of complex, abstract ideas, Samia. And it's also just about a pair of pants.
Totally.
That is Samia talking about her new album, Bloodless. It is out today. Samia, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from RBC Wealth Management, dedicated to providing financial strategies to help navigate wealth planning and legacy building. More at rbcwealthmanagement.com. From Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere. At uma.com/NPR. From Easy Cater, a business tool for food designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend. At easycater.com.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.